From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a writer digs into what pressing issues the Great Lakes face today and finds a complex web.
Invasives are generally considered bad, but then there's introduced fish that are beloved by anglers and, you know, there would be uproar if we tried to get rid of them.
Later, our business and entrepreneurship podcast hums an unusual tune. We speak with a man who built Irish Fest.
And writer James Anderson talks about what draws him to the people who inhabit his novels.
You know that game they used to have that if you say a word, a common word, but if you say it 100 times, it sounds strange? I think the same thing is true of people. And Ben even says that in his book. No matter how well you know somebody, there's always a stranger inside them you don't.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As Milwaukee writer Dan Egan's recent book made clear, the past and future of the Great Lakes are a complicated equation. Humans have had a significant impact on the watershed and the ecosystem in both negative and positive ways.
In the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine, Chicago-based writer Carrie Leiderson went in search of the most pressing issues that the Great Lakes face today and the people who are confronting those issues head-on. She spoke with Lake Effect Susan Bentz and explained that her task was to explore the state of the Great Lakes from various angles.
One of the things that's actually great from an ecological and a resident standpoint, but a little bit tricky as a journalist trying to do a story about the Great Lakes right now, is that a lot of things are actually going well in terms of the progress with the compact and the restoration and the different improvements that have been made since the millennium. So, you know, that makes it a little bit harder to do a sexy journalistic story when there's not a lot of really big, well, there's sort of ongoing crises with the Great Lakes always, but a lot of the things that seemed like big crises a decade ago are looking a little bit better now. But the Foxconn story, you know, is something that's been a huge story in a lot of ways.
Well, I think that listeners will be delighted to hear a journalist assess things on the Great Lakes as or Lake Michigan is going pretty well. But we've got a changed Great Lakes system, don't we? For one thing, invasive species. Let's start. When people read your article, it's structured in sort of three components: the leak, talking about diversions, invaders, and the delicate bellwether. So let's go back to the diversion. So we've got the compact that's 10 years old now. And how would you assess what you saw as being concerned around Foxconn?
Yes, the experts that I talked to described the compact. I mean, the whole idea of the compact, of course, is to protect the water in the Great Lakes and prevent diversions out of the basin while also allowing some very limited and strictly described exceptions. Wisconsin really has been, you know, at the forefront of seeing how the compact plays out and how requests for diversions are dealt with. So a few other diversions, Waukesha and New Berlin specifically, defenders and shapers of the compact seem to be overall pretty satisfied with how those played out. But the Foxconn request is different because it would be really just to serve this one massive company. And there's a lot of other, you know, unrelated concerns, but they're hard to ignore when talking about it. So water to serve this massive foreign company that has also raised issues about the amount of state subsidies it's getting and the land issues and environmental and labor issues that the company as a whole has. But even regardless of that, even if it was the most, well-loved company in the world, it's the idea that the water really isn't needed at this point to serve regular citizens. It would be for Foxconn, and people are worried that with that kind of precedent, you know, not necessarily a legal precedent, or maybe in some ways it would be a legal precedent, other industry, whether it's mining or other big factories in other states anywhere in the basin, could try for a similar concession where a municipality or a county like Racine would be requesting the water, a diversion of the water with the intent of essentially funneling it to a big industrial user. So that's what a lot of people found so troubling. And the other, just I think in some ways small but also intriguing side note that's important to mention is Foxconn's site is actually partly in the basin. And one of the things that I tried to report out a little more but just couldn't understand or get any real answers about is why Foxconn didn't just locate the part of its operations that need the water in the basin, because they actually do have land in the basin as part of their site, and it's not clear why they wouldn't just move the water-intensive operations a third of a mile away, and this whole issue would have been avoided. My just own, you know, personal conclusion or speculation would be that the state officials and Foxconn, if they even knew about this early in the process, just had a really cavalier attitude and, you know, really just didn't care and assumed with the kind of concessions they've gotten in other areas from the government that it wouldn't even be an issue. So I think, you know, as a citizen, that's kind of troubling.
The story of the Great Lakes, is, as you wrote briefly at the beginning of the story, is that the Great Lakes were shaped by nature, and it's humankind, though, that's impacted it and is forging its future. So that leads us to invaders. We've had the ballast water issue through the years and quagga and zebra mussels, gobies, the round gobies. What did you learn about the invaders and how this new balance, if it is a balance, is looks in Lake Michigan in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, ever since I started reporting on the Great Lakes, that's what one of the things that's been most fascinating to me, both invasive species specifically and kind of the larger issue of the way the Great Lakes have been just irreversibly changed by industry and by human civilization, and how, you know, there's really no idea that they're going to go back to some pristine state. So it's a matter of searching for kind of a balance where the lakes are healthier ecologically and can also be used in the way that people want to use them. And of course, there's all these competing priorities within that rubric, and that really plays out with species specifically. And, you know, the issue that invasives are generally considered bad, but then there's introduced fish that are beloved by anglers, and, you know, there would be uproar if we tried to get rid of them. Yeah, I mean, what I've been hearing on the invasive species front for a couple of years, and specifically with the interviews for this story, is that the situation really is exponentially better because of the ballast exchange requirements and the other really aggressive action that's been taken on preventing invasives. So there have been only a couple new invasives found in the last few years, and there's always more concerns. You know, Asian carp is still a concern, and I was on an Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources trip in the St. Lawrence Seaway just recently, where we learned about the tench, which is a fish in the St. Lawrence Seaway that there were, or at least in a tributary of the St. Lawrence Seaway, that they're worried could eventually get into the Great Lakes and have a similar effect to Asian carp, just decimate the base of the food chain. So, and then, of course, if the ballast regulations are rolled back like the Trump administration has already tried to do, then all this progress could be reversed and a lot, you know, new invasives could come in pretty quickly. But it does sound like right now people are feeling pretty good about the progress and the relative lack of new invasives. And actually, one thing I thought was really telling was some of the scientists were seeing that they're focusing even more now on the release of exotic pets and, you know, the actual human introduction of species, aquarium plants being dumped in the lakes or tributaries is also a serious issue. But, you know, the fact they have the luxury of turning their attention to that issue, since that some of the bigger pathways like ballast are at least at the moment stabilized. I thought that was an interesting angle.
So for people who aren't familiar with the ballast regulation, that ships entering the Great Lakes basically need to flush their ballast tanks before entering the system, before entering the basin?
Yeah. So the idea is that species that might be in the ballast tanks will be flushed out. And so apparently that has had a big effect. I mean, there's still an ongoing push to get even stricter regulations that would help kill, you know, any of the things that might still linger after the flushing, or just to otherwise make sure that really nothing is introduced through ballast. But it does sound like the current regulations, which is what the Coast Guard bill could have led to a gutting of that if it had passed the way it was proposed, it does seem like that's been really effective.
One anecdote of your story that struck me is Harvey Wutzma with the School of Freshwater Sciences. He sampled in eliminating mussels in a small area. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think more of an experiment to research. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
By eliminating those mussels, you are altering a system that now depends on those mussels. They benefit snails and worms.
Yeah, exactly. And if you were to eliminate mussels completely, people would probably be upset the water wasn't as clear as we've gotten accustomed to with the mussels. And it would probably hurt these other species, some of them native and desirable, quote unquote, who've actually benefited from the mussels and sort of developed symbiosis with them. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a perfect example of how you just really can't and even shouldn't go back to some pre-invasion, pre-human interference state with the lakes. And it's just this really complex, no right answers struggle to come up with what's the best way to try to manage the ecosystem right now. And then a caveat to that, one of the quotes that struck me the most from Harvey Wutzma was just, I think it was from him, challenging this whole idea that we can manage the lakes is also presumptuous and kind of ridiculous. We've done a ton of harm and we need to try to keep addressing that, but the lakes are a force of their own. And if we think we'll actually be able to manage them, you know, we're going to find that's not the case. The scientists already know that's not the case.
Well, that would be the perfect spot to end, but we have to end with the mayfly.
Oh,
and I mean, intriguing little creature. And one scientist has spent a career in trying to multiply its numbers.
Yeah. So as not a native Midwesterner, I really haven't experienced the massive mayfly phenomena, which I guess is just a part of growing up for a lot of people in the Great Lakes region. So I was fascinated to really learn and see videos of the full intensity of mayflies descending. And then the life cycle is just incredible. And also learned there's this whole subculture of people fascinated by mayflies for good reason. So the scientist who we got to go out on, the photographer and I, on a research cruise, one of the scientists there has been passionate about studying mayflies for much of his career. They are one of the species that have been really affected by ecological changes in the Great Lakes and by mussels specifically, and by the kind of increased muck on the bottom that is caused by nutrient pollution and, you know, the oxygen deprivation that makes it harder to live the part of their life cycle that happens on the lake floor. So even though I know people are still in different places seeing those massive mayfly blooms over the years. But mayflies, that specific species in certain parts of the Great Lakes, have over decades been really decimated and even practically disappeared. And then in recent years have been making a comeback in Lake Erie and Lake Michigan. So this scientist has been studying that and actually seeding mayflies in Lake Michigan. And I think he's seeking funding to continue doing that. But he was feeling positive about how that's going and about how some of the improvements in the lake do seem to be allowing the mayflies, who he's been coaxing along, continue to increase their populations.
So a part of the point, obviously, is that little creature helps animals up the food chain.
Exactly, yeah, right. Yeah. And it has this very short emergence where it's just like a feast for a lot of animals. And the scientists had also made the point that often the mayfly emergence comes at a critical time for other creatures when they really need a lot of protein in their reproductive cycles. So even though it's a short occasional thing, it's a really important part of the food cycle. And it's just a great symbol of the kind of amazing types of wildlife that live in the Great Lakes and how they're all interconnected and how even small ecological changes that affect one can have big changes in the larger picture.
So, Carrie, just reeling out for a final question, when you think about your body of work thus far and you look at policy, technology, economic development, and impacts on vulnerable communities as we look at the issues of the world, how do the Great Lakes and their state and their future factor into the way that you take on your work?
You know, that's a really wonderful question. And I think it gives me So some of the other stories I've been covering recently have been about immigration raids and police violence and human rights issues in prisons. So things that in some ways feel more immediate and more dramatic and more, you know, obvious horror stories involved. So I think the Great Lakes is a good reminder to me of just taking the long view, and the Great Lakes at any given moment, there might not be something that feels as horrible and attention grabbing as an immigration raid on the community. But the challenges to the lakes, you know, over the long term have massive effects on people's well-being and the economy. And then also the work happens over such a long time frame. People worked for more than a decade to get the Great Lakes Compact and some of the other policies in place that have really helped the lakes recover. So I think it's, you know, a good example of just how the things that we take for granted, like Lake Michigan that we might see every day, play such an important role in our life. And it's important to just protect them and appreciate them. And just, you know, for me, seeing the lake, if I'm covering other more disturbing things, just seeing that lake always gives me more of a feeling of peace and perspective.
Carrie Leiderson is a Chicago-based writer. Her feature on the Great Lakes appears in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz.
We'll take a quick break, and then it's How Did You Do That?, our monthly feature on business, innovation, and entrepreneurship. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's time now for our monthly series on business and entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That?, a show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
When we opened up at 4 o'clock on August 21st, 1981, our volunteer coordinator, that was our first big crisis because our volunteer coordinator thought Summerfest would have ticket takers, and they didn't.
Today, we're focusing on something completely different. Our guest is a very successful entrepreneur in a not-for-profit world, and his stockholders, the beneficiaries of his venture, are all of us. He started a venture that requires 4,500 people to run and has 125,000 customers. It's been the guiding force in a global movement that he inspired, shepherded, and grew, and it'll have a lasting influence on Milwaukee.
The venture is called Irish Fest, and it's the brainchild of Ed Ward, a Marquette University-trained lawyer and financial advisor who turned his passion for Irish music into what is arguably the world's most influential Celtic music festival.
Both Kathleen and I have been there many times, of course. I was there for, in the interest of full disclosure, in year one, and we both have an affinity for Irish music. But the story here isn't really just about entertainment, but about how somebody took an idea and grew it on a shoestring and with an army of volunteers into this influential and important venture.
Ed, a musician himself, has been responsible for nurturing new musicians from all over the world, discovering many new groups, and inspiring many other cities to follow the Irish Fest lead. His life's work has been a gift to music lovers everywhere. Ed, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks for saying all those nice things about me.
Hey, Ed, you started Irish Fest in 1981.
Right.
So what's the backstory?
We actually incorporated in 1980. My family had what they call music. So my dad played guitar, loved Irish music. My cousins were into Irish music, my aunt. So I was exposed to it, you know, pretty much as a kid. Didn't really blossom till much later. But when I went to law school at Marquette in 1975, I started a band with law school roommate and another fellow called Blarney. We were not very good. But they decided they liked us, and we sang another time and then another time. And then eventually Blarney had four people in it, and we were singing all over Wisconsin, went out to Cape Cod, other places. We were touring a little bit. And so we really got to know the music then. And when we were obviously playing in a band, my interest, of course, was in learning new songs. We knew about the Clancy Brothers, Tommy Makem, the Irish Rovers. And then my brother and I had started a distribution of Irish and Celtic records, and we'd have a couple sales at a local bar every year. One of the important things about that is we got to know who was playing where, who was touring, who were the hot bands, what was going on in music in Ireland, because we were basically dealing with representatives from two major labels here. So that's kind of the, the story that leads up to and about starting the festival.
And then what?
Well, I love festival. I was a festival junkie, so I was down at Summerfest a lot. But one of the things I liked is being behind the scenes guy. So I volunteered, and, I volunteered where people would come in and say, I got a problem. And then the volunteers at the front desk would say, you need to see so-and-so. I think I did that for 4 years. And I also had friends at Festa Italiana who started 3 years before us. And I worked at Festa Italiana as a volunteer. One night at Festa in 1980, I was standing at or around the midgate. There were six of us standing in a circle. And someone said, you know what, the Irish really should do this. And I said, well, I think you're right. I think they really should. And then that person or some other person said, well, why don't you do it? And I said, well, I will. And so that was the start of it. And then basically what I had to do is I knew Summerfest. I knew the operations. I knew a little bit about how things ran down there. I knew a little bit about Irish music. And because I had worked on political campaigns, I had good political contacts. So I put all this together and I said, well, maybe this is something we can do. Not everybody thought I was right. And so Bernie McCartan, John Maher, and I basically went to the Shamrock Club. We asked for $250 just to get their support, their moral support. And we said, we'll use it to incorporate or open a P.O. box or something. Then we went to the Neville Dunn Post and said, we'd like you guys to support what we're doing here. And then we had an organizational meeting in November of 1980. About 20 people showed up. One guy stood up and said, well, who are you to do this? And I said, well, I'm the guy that probably is going to be responsible for this being a success or failure, and I'm willing to shoulder that responsibility if it's not successful. But the thing is, I had the base. People knew me because of my involvement with the Shamrock Club and other Irish events at the time. I think people trusted me, and I laid out a plan for the festival because I'm a big fan of Walt Disney, and I always have been. And Walt always believed that when you entertain people, you should always educate them also, but don't let them know that. And so when I laid out the plan for how we would do this, we had music, but we also had a really strong cultural component, lots of children's activities. And we weren't going to focus just on the music of Ireland. We wanted to also embrace the history, the culture, the music and dance of Irish America. And that was really important, especially when I went around and asked people to get on the bus that I was driving, because they had at least a vision. And so what I did, the main thing that I provided for Irish Fest, I provided a vision for where we wanted to go. And then I was capable of making decisions on how to get there. And then we started, recruiting people we knew, people that were interested, people we didn't know, and kind of the rest is history.
That first year in 1981, you had six stages and 25 or 30 bands. How big has it grown from that?
This past year, I'm guessing we had 90 bands, 17 stages, and we had a little over 105,000 people. We were averaging before the recession in 08 about 125 to 132,000 a year. Our record was 2005 when we had the president of Ireland, Mary McAleese, here. And that was like having U2 here, and the president of Ireland. Everybody, Chicago and the whole region wanted to come up here, the president of Ireland.
There are a lot of music festivals all over the place, and most of them aren't very big. People
right.
enjoy them and whatever. But this festival, as you said, you've had the president of Ireland here. You've had other people from the government here almost every year.
That's right.
How is it that happened? Why have you had such a huge impact?
Well, I think from the start, let's be clear here. Without the Summerfest grounds, I'm not sure we would have been able to accomplish everything that we have, because that means a great deal in terms of that facility. Is there's nothing like it anywhere that I've seen, and I've traveled to a lot of festivals all over, you know, the world. But the other thing is, I think we developed a reputation very early on for high quality, and I think for good music. We embraced not only the right away, even though we were an Irish fest, we embraced the Celtic culture, because we had a band from Scotland the very first year, and we embraced Irish America, and the fact that there was all of this helped us, and I think musically. And in terms of our partnerships that we've developed, it was a policy of ours to be on the leading edge of what was going on with Celtic and Irish music. In order to do that, we had to get out. We had to go to all the showcases. We had to go to festivals. We had to go to meet with government officials. And we've consistently done that, where we've been out and about meeting people. It's a people business, quite frankly. And so that's the reason that we've been so successful, because we made it a mantra of ours to go out and develop and nourish these relationships.
You're credited with discovering a lot of Irish bands and helping them get a start in their trajectory. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. Once we established that we were a successful festival, we started getting LPs, press kits, cassettes, hundreds of them every year. And back then, everybody was just wanted to be here. And the word kept going, and you got to go to Milwaukee. So in 1998, you know, Gaelic Storm had just come off the big movie, The Titanic. And so we had a little discussion of, well, why don't we call these guys up and see if they would want to play the festival? And Jane Anderson and I, Jane was a director at the time, really thought it was a great idea. Not everybody did. But so we contacted them. And they said yes. So, and as it turns out, I wrote a letter to them, and I said, we were willing to take a chance on you. You were willing to take a chance on us. We put them in what is the Pottawatomi stage at Summerfest now. And it was packed. We brought them in on Thursday night, and it was you couldn't even get in. And so here's a band that we knew would probably be lots of fun. And it was so fun that we actually, after they played the first time in Milwaukee, we set up two tables over by the Lake Walk, and they signed albums for 2 hours. We even added another show on Saturday night. After that, we knew that, and they knew, this is a good deal for us. This is a good deal for them. In 2011, I went to a house concert in Maquanago with Paul Brock Band and Manus McGuire Band. They had a banjo player named Enda Cahill from Galway, who was just brilliant. And so during the intermission at the house concert, I'm talking to him. He says, hey, I got another band I'm starting. It's a couple brothers from Galway, and they're called the Howley Brothers. I said, well, let us know about them, because we can put you on a small stage if you will get you kick-started. And so We Banjo 3 showed up in 2012, but they said, well, we're going to Milwaukee. We can't just bring three guys. We better bring another. So they added Enda's brother, Fergal, came in. First gig they had in the pub tent was crowded, but the crowd kept building over the weekend, and by the end of the weekend, you couldn't even get in the tent to hear them. Another successful, you know, experiment.
So, Ed, I think you're being a little modest. When you met Wee Banjo 3, they weren't playing music full time.
No, they were not.
And if it weren't for you guys, they probably still wouldn't be.
Well, the question is, could they have been discovered? But I don't know the answer to that, but certainly their fact that they played here and that kicked off their career, there's no doubt about that.
So the you've grown the festival so much, and it's gotten such a global reputation. Do you get inquiries and visits from people doing other festivals?
Oh, yes, all the time. I mean, if you look at what we have a lunch every year for our sister festivals. They come in, festivals from all around the country, Irish festivals, some that are operating, some that are thinking of starting. But we have a big family nationally now, because in 1998, we hosted 7 festivals at our center in Wauwatosa. And then we hosted a second one in 2005. And since then, our sister festivals have hosted conferences in lots of other cities around the country. It's a friendly competition, but people will come here because they see this as a showcase where they can find the new bands, new things. On the other hand, we go to other festivals. We're not at all remiss about picking up new ideas and stealing ideas. Absolutely, that's important. I want to say one other thing, though, because we're talking about all these well-known bands. When I started the festival, we made a commitment to anybody that was a local dancer or singer or musician, they could play at the festival. And we still adhere to that because I've seen other festivals who have disenfranchised local musicians, and it was one of the reasons they failed. So we have committed to, if anybody's playing or promoting Celtic music, culture, dance, we want to support them.
And I'll tell you, I played there for 10 years, and it was always a great time. So thanks for doing that. Hey, so how do you manage all these volunteers?
I'm happy to say that that's not my job. We started out with 300 volunteers the first year. When we opened up at 4 o'clock on August 21st, 1981, our volunteer coordinator, that was our first big crisis because our volunteer coordinator thought Summerfest would have ticket takers, and they didn't. And so here's Mary Otto at the main gate on August 21st, 1981, picking people out as they come in and asking them to take tickets for us. So, well, now we've got about 4,400 volunteers. And it's something that we have about 120 people work year-round. We've got them well organized. They all have areas. They've got areas. They have coordinators they report to, and the coordinators have areas supervisors they report to, and the area supervisors report to the board.
And they would only do it because they love you, Ed.
Well, they love what they're doing, but you know, I think they're happy because it's a successful event. It's well run. It's run like a business. It's internationally known now, which is another reason. But we get most of our volunteers by word of mouth, obviously. But they want to be affiliated and they want to be associated with a successful event.
Ed, I just got to ask you, you worked in the military after serving in Vietnam. You worked in U.S. Congress. You're a lawyer. You're a financial advisor. But you always came back to all things Irish. For the record, how Irish are you?
I want to add one thing. I was in the Peace Corps before I went into the military. That was really important to me. Well, I can only tell you that my sister took one of these DNA tests when she was 98% Irish. I think they call it British Isles. But the Cagney side of my family, my mother's side, Cagneys were from Limerick. That's not a real common Irish name. And then my grandfather was from Meath. He immigrated to America in 1900, so we're very Irish.
I'd say pretty darn Irish.
Yeah. My sophomore year in high school, they asked me what my nationality was. I put on Irish, and a nun came over and slapped me in the face.
Well,
that's your story.
We'll save that for another time.
Yeah.
So, Ed, this has been a great treat, and it's a great gift to the city and the state and Ireland, and I can't thank you enough for coming on, and we sure look forward to seeing you again in August.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Ed. If you want to suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That, go to WUWM.com. And be sure to listen to our other podcasts at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
We should mention that the music in this episode is a 2015 performance by Wee Banjo 3 in the Lake Effect Studio. It's a song called Ba-Dump Ba-Dump.
One last break, and then we'll visit with writer James Anderson, who brings us another atmospheric novel of the American Southwest. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. For a setting that is often bright and wide open, writer James Anderson manages to find some dark places in it. Anderson's first novel, The Never Open Desert Diner, told an intriguing but dark tale featuring a Utah truck driver named Ben Jones.
Anderson's follow-up features Jones and some of the other mysterious and lonely characters from his first book. Lullaby Road is no less atmospheric and no less intriguing than Anderson's previous effort. He joined us recently in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome back to the show. James Anderson, welcome back to Lake Effects.
It is so terrific to be here. Thank you, Mitch.
And congratulations. The new book is not all that new anymore, but it's a new paperback at this point.
Today's publication date.
As we have this conversation, it is just out in paperback. I want to start by, if you would, having you read the first page and a half of this novel.
Sure. Here we go. A momentary silence was all that marked the passing of summer into winter. After living most of my almost 40 years in the high desert of Utah, 20 driving a truck, I had come to the conclusion there were really only two seasons, hot and windy and cold and windy. Everything else was just a variation on those two. Late in the evening, I lay half awake in my single bed and knew the silence meant the season had changed. I like to think maybe I know a thing or two about silence. Real silence is more than the absence of sound. It is something you feel. A few heartbeats earlier, a steady wind scattered the leftover sounds from the evening, a car passing, neighbors talking from behind closed doors, somewhere a dog barking, all the usual muffled racket of nearby lives. Then there was nothing. Nothing at all. As if the desert and everyone in it had vanished and left nothing behind but an indifferent starless light. By 4 a.m., when I begin my workday, winter was on its hind legs and waiting. It took longer than usual to get to the transfer station and load my truck. The time was well after 5 o'clock when I finally got underway, driving cautiously through the light snow and ice in the pre-dawn darkness. My heater was blowing full blast and the bitter, dry cold hijacked the warmth through my body and cracked my skin into something akin to a hard pan lake bed. My last routine stop was to take on diesel. I had missed the morning fueling rush, if there had been one, by being either a few minutes early or a few minutes late. All of the pump islands were empty. Cecil Boone was the manager of the Stop and Gone truck stop on US 191 just outside of Price, Utah. The Stop and Gone was a cheapo independent, stuck out alone in a patch of sand and broken rock, with the rundown look of a place that must have low prices because it didn't have much of anything else. Cecil was a stubby, sour man in his 50s. We were inside the small convenience store, and Cecil was behind the register. In the 8 or so years I had been buying my diesel there, nearly every weekday, I had never seen the man smile before that snowy October morning. There are probably a lot of reasons to smile. Most folks do it every day. In my line of work, I don't see many smiles, and I probably don't give many. Not even to myself. That was the way it should be. No one wants to glance up and see a truck driver grinning. My sense is that such a sight is bound to have an unsettling effect on the ordinary driver. I was quickly sorting through the reasons people smile, humor, warmth, trivial annoyance, and coming up short. It was just Cecil and me and Cecil's smile.
That's James Anderson reading the opening to Lullaby Road. First of all, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well read.
And I wasn't going to start here, but the observation right at the end of that is something I never stopped to think of before. You never do see truck drivers smiling because it would be unsettling.
Yes. In fact, a few people, have mentioned that to me. Of course, you'd have to be able to look up in a way and actually see them. But if you could, I think there's a certain there's a lot in the mythology of truck drivers, starting, with Thelma and Louise and Steven Spielberg's first one.
Right, the one about the truck.
Yeah, the Phantom truck. So you start thinking, since you're down in a smaller car or whatever, that you've just been lowered on the food chain and something bad's going to happen.
There's a lot of bad that happens in the pages of this latest novel. But the thing that amazes me about your writing is we learn a lot about the setting. We learn plenty about Ben's way of thinking just from these first, I don't know, 6-7 paragraphs of the novel. You must put a lot of stock in your first chapter.
I do. And I was going to try and make it somehow punchier and more interesting. And so I wrote something else. I'd written that, and I wrote something else, and I had a chance to run it by Andre Debuse III and Laura Lippman and so on, but they didn't know who wrote it. And I think I set a record at the writer's conference I was at. As soon as they dislike something, they raised their hands. And on my previous opening that I'd written, they all put their hands up after about the third word. And so the thing is that the late David Bowie used to say, don't play to the stands. Do what you feel. And I decided, if I'm going to write something that's not good, I'm going to do it on my own terms. And one of the most rewarding things about writing The Never Open Desert Diner and now this one is, originally I thought, well, the literary fiction people are going to hate it and the mystery people are going to hate it. As it turned out, both liked it. So I write what I feel and experience, and I try to be true to that, because I often read things out loud to myself, because they tend to be, they lend themselves to voice. And truck drivers I know have told me that they listen to it on Audible, you know. So it's knowing that you're telling a good yarn, that you're telling a good story. But I pay a lot of attention to writing because, as you know, I know a lot of poets. I read a lot of poetry, and I'm very much in tune to the musicality of language.
It's interesting. The paperback edition of the book actually includes an excerpt from your first novel at the end of this one, which means, I suppose, that people who are coming into this with this novel might look at the previous one as a prequel.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who missed The Never Open Desert Diner, give us a thumbnail sketch of our hero. What's Ben Jones's story?
Well, Ben Jones, as far as he knows, is a Native American Jewish. The way the story goes on the reservation is that his mother was a Jewish social worker and his father was a Native American at the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon. But he doesn't know. He was abandoned at the little reservation medical clinic. And he spends some time at the Indian school before he's adopted by a Mormon, an older childless Mormon couple in Utah. So in a lot of ways, he's like the ultimate exile, who then becomes a truck driver serving the ultimate exiles, which, even though he wouldn't admit it, are kind of his family. They're oddballs. They're eccentrics. They're all orphans, at least spiritually. You know, they're orphans.
Well, and it really raises the question of whether, if you add a group of people who by fate or by choice are kind of loners or are off the grid, do you create a de facto community?
I think you do. It's a community of exiles. And in fact, in The Never Open Desert Diner, Ben observes that the only thing that they have in common is that they don't want to have anything in common. But they also realize, and this is restated again or emphasized in Lullaby Road, that they know that they're connected, that they have to depend on each other. And that's one of the themes of the book. Paradox, certainly, but the idea that when you're in such a harsh environment, you whatever your political ideology is, that melts away, because character is all about who you are when no one's looking. And if somebody turns their back on you, it means that you start that chain of events where people start turning their backs on one another. So so people rely on each other in a very kind of strange, detached way.
What draws you to these kinds of lives?
You know, this particular book, Lullaby Road, is about children at risk. I was a child at risk. My mother and sister and I was 2 and a half. My sister was an infant. Our father abandoned us at a Greyhound bus station. And eventually a Quaker couple took us in and gave us a place to live and helped my mom get a job and so on. I've been asked, I was at this great big fan convention called BoucherCon, which was in St. Petersburg, and I was asked the question about how much research I do. And of course, everybody, you know, saying, well, I do this, I do that. And I said, you know, not a lot. These are my people. I worked on crews of men, you know, commercial fishing and logging and masonry. And so everybody, it's like, you know, that game they used to have that if you say a word, a common word, but if you say it 100 times, it sounds strange. I think the same thing is true of people. And Ben even says that in his book. No matter how well you know somebody, there's always a stranger inside them you don't. So these are people who are scared and sometimes desperate, but are most of them essentially good people, and they work hard. And, you know, not to beat this too hard, but that's the thing about Ben Jones. An agent one time when I was trying to sell my first book said, well, what's his superpower? You know, and I knew what the agent was asking for, and I didn't have an answer because Ben's an ordinary guy. But what Ben's superpower is a superpower of the ordinary guy who gets up every day, or woman, gets up every day, puts their shoes to the floor, and goes to work. There are no parades. You know, they're not a Nobel-winning physicist who is a former nun who, you know, the kinds of superpowers. And for me, that's heroic. That's courageous. No parades, no thank you, small paycheck.
Throughout the novel, Ben is still working through the ghosts of what happened to him in the previous novel, and mm-hmm. and honestly, what's happened to him throughout his life. But he's not the only one working through old ghosts. In fact, nearly everyone in this book is kind of working through the things that have haunted them for, in some cases, decades.
Well, and that's another connection with the title, because we are ghosts, our own ghosts. We're the children of our own ghosts. And people go to the desert usually to escape themselves, or they think to escape something else. And at one point, Ben is talking about you have to be really careful about going out into desert to live in solitude, because you don't want to bring anything out there with you, because whatever it is, it will grow in the desert. It'll grow in solitude.
The hardcover of this book came out the beginning of the year, I think.
January, February, somewhere.
Yeah. In the time that you had a chance to tour with that and visit with people who'd read it, are there things that you were able to take from other people's either interpretation or enjoyment or not enjoyment of the book that you didn't realize things that you didn't realize were there until you heard how people received it?
Yes. and no. I don't work from an outline. I write the rough draft. It takes me about 6 months. And for me, it's like being a sculptor. You have to haul that big piece of rock out there, look at the grain and say, oh, I see a head here or an arm there or a smile or whatever, and then begin sculpting. For me, it's a very physical experience. And I think the fact that I experience literature, my own writing, in particular, physically, I experience it emotionally, that I think that it takes a toll on me. And one of the things that's happened is a number of people have said, wow, was that tough to live with every day? And I went, yeah, it was. And I think that that goes to the authenticity of what people feel. And yes, there were a lot more connections because it's about kids, it's about generations. One of the things that's come up more is how I'm not particularly interested in the actual commission of a crime. What interests me is what I call the geological personal time, geological crime time, because there's never just one victim to a crime. And so you're out in the desert where this long, the vastness of geological events. So the parallel is, in the first book, we know what the crime is. And now we're seeing how that crime has stretched out across people's lives in generations, affecting some who weren't even born at the time of that crime. So in a way, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but it's like literary butterfly theory, or what is it called?
Butterfly effect, right, yeah.
Butterfly effect. So, there's always more than one victim. And in a setting like the desert, where there are so few people and so few resources, you have a chance to really see how that plays out in our lives every day.
James Anderson, thank you so much again for your time and for your wonderful way with words.
Thank you, Mitch, very much.
Oregon writer James Anderson is the author of Lullaby Road, which is recently out in paperback. You can listen back to his previous interview with us about the Never Open Desert Diner at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Monday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.